This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by two One Heat Minute Productions. The first, Ingram Advice, 45 episodes, deep diving on Paul Thomas Anderson's 2014 masterpiece based off Thomas Pynchon's novel Inherent Vice called Ingram Advice, hosted by Travis Woods, produced by myself, Blake Howard, and narrated by the awesome Kat Corbett, takes a myriad of unbelievable guests through this sort of stoner noir masterpiece. Megan Abbott, Jordan Harper, Drew McWeeny, Matt Zoller-Zeitz, Walter Chaw, Karina Longworth, Ryan Johnson. Get listening. And if you're into fiction, it came from the deep. Maria Lewis, the host of our Josie and the Podcast podcast, is here with her very own audiobook, It Came From the Deep, and an after show co-hosted by myself. That's in its own feed. It Came From the Deep, Ingram Advice. Search them wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's get to it.
There was a time when actors who made their lives on the stage were referred to as ladies and gentlemen of the theater. And that's exactly what Jason Robards has always been for me, a gentleman of the theater. Stage acting requires a kind of wildness, a kind of take it or leave it quality, a dangerous quality, qualities that Jason has in abundance. When I came to New York in 1962, he was already the standard by which great acting on the stage was measured. I watched him and I learned. And Jason, I share your opinion that acting is a noble profession. And the greatest challenge of all, I think, for those of us who practice it, is to make it look as if we're not doing it. So Jason, I came here tonight to tell you, nobody not does it better than you. Congratulations.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. My guest today needs no introduction because if you've been listening to this show, he kicked it off. If you've been listening to One 8-Minute Productions, he pops up regularly and usually drops science in really some of the biggest scenes of the movies. He's one of the only people that I kind of give carte blanche to pick whatever he wants because I love talking to him so much. He's a dear friend. He's literally the reason that Michael Mann came on One Heat Minute. And he's just one of the funnest movie minds that exists. And it's when he starts to praise old Liam Neeson work. It's when he starts to praise Final Destination on the internet that I think we really see his truest self come out and reflect just all the power that he has inside. But I love him for doing this show and coming on and kicking it off. And he said all the way back then in the first episode, let me come on in the first just in case this thing crashes and burns halfway through. And 2020 hasn't crashed us yet. You're hearing this after the result of the US election. We are recording it before. He's my dear friend, Bilge Ibiri. Bilge, welcome back to All the President's Minutes.
Thank you for having me back. What's that they say in Citizen Kane? I was here before the beginning and now I'm here after the end.
You are. And I'm gonna love hoping that the hope and the fun of our conversation is leading towards a hopeful American outcome. You know, this is the year I just spoke in terms of time, and folks are going to be listening to it, to Josh Rothkopf, really great film critic and critical voice. And he said, you know, the year 1976, we were talking about, it has Network, it has Taxi Driver, but it also has Rocky and All the President's Men. So it is that kind of like chaos right at the tipping point, and then this sort of heroic triumphant air that like things are going to get better. So hopefully that is, that's lending to that.
Oh boy. I don't know. We'll see. It's 2 weeks to go. I'm very nervous, but we'll never, you know. But now, you know what? All the President's Men will still be around after the election too. So, you know.
It will still be here. We spoke 132 minutes ago in this movie. We've gone from like basically a black screen to arguably the greatest moment in the entire film. It's the 133rd minute. If you're looking at it on your dial, it is 2 hours and 12 minutes. It is the Ben Bradley monologue, maybe one of the greatest monologues in the history of American cinema. Jason Robards winning himself an Oscar with a single monologue here. You know, we went from a black screen and talking about the cooler and talking about how awesome the Pelican Brief is. But I think in this moment, like, this is the moment. This is the moment of presidents. If you say All the President's Men to even a passive viewer, they're like, oh, that Robards is Bradley scene. That, you know, wash out 15 minutes, get your asses back in gear. That might be the greatest piece of dialogue in movie history. Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah,
did I lose you? Oh, did I lose you? Sorry. I thought I lost you for a second.
I thought you were queuing up the video.
No. I wasn't queuing up the minute. I was queuing you up, and then we're going to go to the minute.
I thought you were queuing up the minute. No, it's a great monologue, but also I think it's kind of the moment when, you know, the whole film has had this trajectory towards this scene, really. This scene and then the scene that comes right after it.
Yes.
Which are kind of the two like aesthetic themes over the course of the film, right? Because you know, the film starts with a blank page and, you know, words hitting a blank page. And the whole film is really about words and the way that these guys, you know, use words. And over the course of the film, that sort of becomes its own thing. Like it develops towards something very different. By the end. So like right after this, and I think I get 5 seconds of that next shot, right? With them, you know, in the office. So that's one thread, one aesthetic thread. And then the other one is the journey towards darkness, right?
Yes.
And, you know, go from like the brightly lit offices and kind of the daylight meetings and things like that, and then it, you know, and then it just plunges you into dark. I mean, there's plenty of darkness in the film throughout because, you know, because of the cinematography, but but it really, it's like pitch black by the end. And that scene, you know, the fact that it's happening at night and it has to happen outside, you can barely see their faces. You know, what's that line that John McCain always used to say that I think is actually one of the great lies of history, but it's still a good line, which is the line was, it's always darkest before the dawn.
The dawn, yes.
Of course, John McCain's version of it was, it's always darkest before it gets pitch black. but that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the knife's edge on which the denouement of this film is balanced, right?
Let's now watch this minute.
Now that I've like said it all.
And you've said it all, but we've got to watch this minute. It's so wonderful. We'll just let the minute speak for itself. Bilger and I are going to watch it together right now. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know the results of the latest Gallup poll? Half the country never even heard of the word Watergate. Nobody gives a shit. You guys are probably pretty tired, right? Well, you should be. Go on home. Get a nice hot bath. Rest up 15 minutes. Then get your asses back in gear. We're under a lot of pressure, you know, and you put us there. Nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment of the Constitution, freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country. Not that any of that matters, but if you guys fuck up again, I'm going to get mad. Good night.
There it is.
All right. right? So I don't get a few seconds of the...
No, you don't. You don't.
Is this a PAL NTSC situation here?
I don't know what it is, but this is the Blu-ray that we've been using as the Blu-ray and the VOD that we've been using as the single source of truth, if you like. So here we are. It might be an old PAL NTSC thing, but oh man, I love... There's just certain little elements. It's like, I love knowing that they're outside because you can see the tiny hairs on his head flickering in the breeze. There's just something about in that moment, they know that they're shooting outside, but they're going to shoot it outside and can't hide that, you know, almost like documentary quality of like, we're outside. And so his hair's going to flutter. And so we can't mess this cut up. He has to hit this monologue. He's basically got 60 seconds to do it. And we're going to do it until he gets it right. And it is what it is. It's just such a, after all the revelations, after seeing him usually dispense wisdom with his feet up on a desk or with a beautiful press suit, he's there in his pajamas on his front lawn, just like dropping science to these two guys. I just can't get enough of this scene. I probably watched it 30 times before we spoke today. I just love every second of it.
It's beautiful because it's also, his character's trajectory is so interesting. In some ways, it's a conventional, you know, movie character trajectory. You know, he has to be convinced. But, you know, if you look at the way that he is earlier in the film, when he is in some ways their main obstacle, right?
Yes.
And he's the guy who kind of is skeptical. And also there is this, you know, kind of vague sense that he doesn't want to touch this thing because it's going to really mess up his whole situation, right?
Yes. I mean,
you know, he's a member of the power elite. I mean, this is, we see this in the post as well. And Ben Bradley was always kind of this very fascinating figure, perched between the world of journalism and the world of politics and power and, you know, the chummy old boy networks and things like that. I mean, he was John F. Kennedy's neighbor for years, you know? You know, so over the course of the film, you know, his body language is so interesting because the little things that he does to indicate where he is in his journey,
yes,
right? Like there's that one scene, I can't remember when exactly it happens, but it's kind of later, you know, where he says something. And then as he's walking away, you know, he like taps his little fingers and you can sense that he's just got this, there's a little bounce in his step.
Run that baby. And he taps
the desk. It's kind of that moment of triumph, that initial, like, you know, false moment of triumph right before, you know, things fall apart. But because Robards is such an even keeled actor, you know, he kind of has that same voice no matter what he's doing, right? I mean, that's the same voice that you hear in Once Upon a Time in the West. It's Jason Robards. I mean, for a guy who actually transformed quite a bit in movies, there is just this, like, Jason Robards-ness to him that never really goes away.
No. That's the difference between the Battle of Cable Hoag and Once Upon a Time in the West, because with Cable Hoag, if there's a flaw in the movie, it's the premise that you believe that Jason Robards would eventually struggle. Like, he feels like he's such a more savvy, he's not the guy who's witless. He's a guy who's very witty and seems to be around. And so the latter parts of Cable Hoag are very satisfying. It's like when you see him in Once Upon a Time in the West, you're like, yeah, this is a guy who's seen it all. He kind of has the answers. He knows it. And that's that. He just he's dressing it up as Bradley, but those, you know, what's that great Indiana Jones quote? It's not the years, it's the mileage. Like, this guy's got some mileage, man. He's done it.
He's oracular. Is that the word, oracular? Like he is like, there is something, like, that's the feeling you get watching All the President's Men, is that in some weird way, it's almost like he has all the secrets. Like, he's not deep throat. He's not in bed. Like, he doesn't know what's going on, but he, like, has all the secrets to even journalism, right? I mean, you know, they give him a sheet and he can, like, as he's talking with one guy, he can, like, mark up copy that he's, like, literally reading as he's, like, he can just do it. He just gets it. And, you know, in my experiences as a writer at various magazines, newspapers and whatnot, I have come across people like this. They just, like, even though they may not necessarily be the greatest editor ever or the greatest writer ever or the most successful editor ever, there's just something second nature about the fact that they know They know when the story is the story. They know when it's right. They know what it needs. It's like, it's intuitive for them.
Yes.
At this point. And I don't even know if Ben Bradlee in real life was like that, but the way the film portrays him is like that. So that he is like, I mean, I hate this term because I don't play video games, but he becomes like the final boss, you know,
yeah.
Like he's, he's like the last guy that yeah. they have to kind of not defeat. He's on their side, but he's the last guy that they have to sort of unlock.
But I also think you make a great point about his role is that he's not their friend. He's not their chum, but he's an obstacle and they have to really, like when you get to him, you almost have to present him like he's like giving you a riddle that you're not really sure if you're going to completely unlock or solve. You have to go there and present it. And what's so amazing is in this moment, they're waking him up in the middle of the night. They're dragging him out of his house in a robe. Like there's none of the formality or the hierarchy or all the protections and all that stuff that just sort of has the legend of Ben Bradlee around it, his office, the, you know, the editorial, you know, meeting room or any of that. It's here sort of as candid as he could be. And they present him with the most undeniable information and he sits there and processes it. And just for the split seconds at the beginning of this minute, you actually have no idea what he's going to say to them. Like whether he's going to say you're a lunatic, whether you're going to say that. And what's wonderful is the way that he's like, he doesn't say if this is true. He just says, you guys have got work to do. You know, we're teetering on the pressure and he kind of gives them the permission to go and finish this damn story and know where it's going to go. And I just, you know, and finally, you know, there's none of this, like where the hell is this goddamn story anymore? It's that response, that huge pregnant pause in the movie waiting for him to process all the information they've just dumped on him. He is like a final boss because they actually unlock him and they're like, cool, we now get the advice, we get the pat on the back and we get to move on and solve the story.
And if you think about it, one of the geniuses of this screenplay, and maybe, you know, if I, maybe one day I'll sit down and go over all the various, you know, Goldman scripts and see if this runs, this is an ongoing thing through them, but the script is almost structured as a series of riddles.
Yes.
Right. I mean, that's kind of that's the mystery element, but you know, Deep Throat knows stuff, but he's only going to give you certain things. So you have to kind of piece together, but like there's people out there who know things, you know, it's not a mystery in the sense that like nobody knows anything except like the one guy who did it and something, you know, you have to be brilliant and piece everything together. It's, everybody they meet knows what the fuck is happening.
Yes, yes.
Right? They're the only ones who don't know what's going on. Right? And even Bradlee, it winds up being kind of like that. Even though he doesn't know what's happening, he's the guy who finally says the future of American democracy is on the line. And one of the genius things about this movie, and maybe this is the way that you know, Hollywood storytelling has evolved over the years. I love the fact that the stakes, and maybe to be fair, it might also be because everybody knew this story already at the time. But I love the fact that the real stakes are revealed at the end of the movie.
Yes.
Or at least stated at the end of the movie. Maybe we know the stakes, but it's not like, you know, it's not in the first 15 minutes that someone says, only, you know, truth, justice, and the American way are on the line. It's like, you wait till the very end of the movie, and he's like, oh, by the way, this is what happens if you fuck up. You know?
I love the balls of that, though. Don't you just, I think there's been a couple of guests who've talked about it in roundabout ways, and I've kind of chunked their observations into this key quote, which is that, like, the history that bookends this movie is bigger than a film. And so the genius is how this movie injects itself into the sort of linear history and says, we're just going to be the microscope on these two guys at this moment, at this sort of avalanche moment before all of these revelations start pouring through. And actually the state of American democracy is, you know, the events that it sort of impacts can be stated, but I love that. And then I also love that, like, after all the doubt and after just these swelling moments of paranoia and this is happening, that you can punctuate it and go, this is actually what is at stake and what was at stake this whole time. And it's almost like the genius of the line, follow the money. Follow the money is not a line that is in the book. It's a William.
Nobody ever said follow the money, right?
No, it's a William Goldmanism that has now informed the next five decades almost of investigative journalism, or like that's the shorthand for how you uncover, you know, sort of the inherent political corruption or inherent corruption in sort of, you know, criminality, is that there will always be an entanglement with money. If you can follow the money and see who is actually benefiting, you know, qui bono, who benefits from all of this shit, you will find the bad guys. There, it will start to come out. And yeah, I just love that he's finally like, you know, maybe the First Amendment, freedom of the press and the future of the country.
Yeah. And this is also the thing that we've talked about, right? Which is the fact that back then, and for some years after, we talked about this when we talked about The Insider, you could have a movie whose triumphant climax was journalists get the story and it's published in the paper, you know, or it's on 60 Minutes and that's it. We know, you know what happens after this, roll credits.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But the difference here is, and what I love about both those endings is that things are going to get published and ultimately we know that, you know, some good things happen, but the delicacy of the film to kind of just add that little bit of an asterisk on both these films that says these guys had to keep working. Nixon got reelected with everything we even know right at this moment, which should knock our socks off in the minute preceding this minute. And then Bradley's reaction, he still gets reelected. And after everything, it's like, yeah, Lowell finally pushes the story online. And then he just steps out into the flux, out of that turnstile. And it's like, the world's different. See how much we had to fight to just get one story up. We had to fight the entire corporation to get this done. This is not good. This is not good. And I love both of those endings for that. I think they have a great kinship together because it's like work still needs to be done, but we don't necessarily have all the answers. We just know that work needs to still be done and the fight needs to endure. And hopefully people have got the energy to keep fighting, because in this movie, we do. We see them. They're typing. That chorus of beautiful typewriters just typing Nixon being inducted and reelected. And we don't know right now as we're talking whether there's going to be some awful reelection happening in the United States of Donald Trump. You know, hopefully, maybe I'll give you a phone call at the end of, I'll give you a phone call and we can just tack it on to the end of this episode if we actually know the outcome of the
election. It'll just be me screaming on the other end. It'll be like a, suddenly it becomes a podcast about Event Horizon.
Get me out of here. You're just getting in a boat. You start paddling in a dinghy off of Manhattan and you're like, I'm out.
It's just a little Zoom video of me like with my eyeballs in my hands. Backwards Latin. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the Robards' performance is also, because he's so even keeled, there's something very comforting about it. Mm. And there's something very, you know, even though he does present an obstacle to these guys, you know, over the course of the film, that sort of very laid back style of speaking that he has, you know, really speaks to kind of the way the establishment works. Right, the way that, you know, things are moving along. We kind of know what's going on. Yeah, you got the story. I don't know, you know. And then by the end, when he's fully on board, and before this, by the way, I mean, also right before this, there's that great scene at when they're going around the editor's table talking about this like colossal fuck up where they published the story about, you know, Haldeman being named and he wasn't. I mean, obviously it's a momentary setback, but in the course of this film, it's a cliffhanger.
It's a
failure, you know.
Huge.
Like they screwed up. But that little moment where he passes the little piece of paper and here's my response. We stand by our story. I think that's, you know, suddenly like, this is a sense that the establishment is starting to turn.
Yes.
And in many ways, Bradley, even though he's targeted by the Nixon administration and they don't like him very much, there is something about Bradley, which is when you've finally convinced him, he's on your side, and he goes from being your primary obstacle to being your primary enabler, something has turned.
Yes.
And I think that's really important.
Especially the eloquence with which he backs them.
Yeah.
Fuck it. We'll stand by the boys.
Yeah.
There is nothing, there's almost nothing better than that. Fuck it. We'll stand by the boys. Like the scrutiny that they've been under, how many people have validated what they said and actually then hearing where there might've been the trapdoors in some of their approach, but just still knowing it foundationally, like it's like you said, everyone in the city knows Haldeman's involved. Maybe someone didn't mention him to the grand jury, but we all know he's involved. Like, and that's the call that he has to make at that moment is we know he's involved and we may not have the source on that just yet, but you bet your bottom dollar we're going to get it. And then obviously the vindication is that they do get it and he is very involved, as are a number of other people. But yeah, no, I there's just something about, like you said, that relaxed nature, that relatability that he, you know, as sophisticated as he is, it's just that Bradley, you know, he's a sophisticated, he's a power broker, but at the same time, he can be like, fuck it, let's stand by the boys.
Yeah. I think also and this doesn't relate to this minute specifically, but to kind of what's around it. You know, I was talking earlier about the way words work in the movie. I mean, words on paper work in the movie. Obviously, we had that opening scene with the typing and the text and all that. But you know, if you look at the way that Woodward and Bernstein work over the course of the film, you know, they go from like these like pads filled with just like random notes, and it's like this giant soup of stuff. And sometimes it speaks to the fact that they don't really know what the story is. They don't even know if the story is a real story. And those words on paper become more and more organized as the film progresses, until they are communicating that scene where they're at the typewriter. They stop talking and they are now communicating with each other via the typewriter. Obviously, there is a reason why they're doing that, but I think that's right before, right after Bradley passes the note. And so, like, words suddenly, you know, the film comes down to, words on paper are monumental, and in many ways they're more important than a word, you know, you saying something in casual conversation.
Yes.
And which then leads to that final shot of them at the typewriters in the office, where they have gone from being these two guys who were at odds, or these two guys who were kind of working separately in different realms and trying to piece things together, and sometimes, to like right before this Bradley scene, it's like Hoffman is, Bernstein is like speaking for Woodward. Like Woodward says, you know, Woodward says we're not safe. Woodward says we have to go outside. Like, you know, right? So like they've gotten to that, like finishing each other's sentences points. And then the next scene is they are now a well-oiled machine. They are just sitting there typing away. And this is like, they are now doing the thing. They are focused. They're working together. They're just like, whatever it is that they're typing there, that's going to undo like what's happening on that TV screen, which is where no news happens, you know?
where nothing meaningful happens on the TV, you know?
Yeah,
you know?
That's a very 70s way of, you know, the TV.
I've said it a few times now, but you know, I used to always think of Network and All the President's Men as polar opposites. But now I see them as siblings, as two siblings at a table. I think of how different, you know, I am to my siblings, and I'm like, but we grew up in the same house, we're under the same environment, and we're just different people. And I'm like, there's a kinship between those two movies and their approaches and their philosophy that I think is, you know, there's a lot of, you know, pomp and circumstance, and Network's obviously being much more brazen with what it's trying to say. But I just think there's so much of a kinship between both of them, in what matters and what's not going to matter in a much closer way than I think the reads of the film for many years have been able to tell. And I think it's like 2020 has like crystallized them, and like, nah, they're siblings for me. They're sitting at the same table.
Yeah. It's interesting. I always think of Pakula as of that TV generation of directors, but he wasn't. You know, I think of him in the same breath as like Frankenheimer and Sidney Lumet and all these guys who came of who came up through the world of like live television drama in the 50s and 60s. He wasn't. He absolutely wasn't. He came up through the studio system and was a producer. And I don't know I don't know what that says, but other than the fact that, you know, he probably felt some kind of kinship with those folks, but it is interesting. I do think of him in that vein. So I always think of him as somebody who really kind of understood TV and the nature of journalism and the nature of, you know, the televised image versus words on a page done by real journalists, you know? You know, his later films, like Rollover, I mean, those all get into that kind of stuff too, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And there is a great kinship between those guys because they all kind of like, you know, as they approach the 80s and the 90s, they're not making the movies. They're not making the movies that people necessarily like outwardly want, but they make movies that are a great curiosity and a great rewarding revisit because they're not like the money makers. They're not the blockbuster generation. They're not that kind of, they're not making Reagan era movies. These guys just don't make them. That's why some of them reemerge in the 90s and still making really fascinating kind of 70s style or like 70s lens 90s movies, like The Pelican Brief, for example, where you're like, oh, this is great. Like, this is kind of like what the world really is. It's not just this, you know, escapist popcorn thing. It's something a little bit darker and a little bit different and very morally complex.
And these filmmakers, I think, also suffered. They suffered for a couple of reasons. One, they didn't get on board the blockbuster kind of fairy tale train. Yes. Which nobody would have expected them to. I mean, you know, I mean, the closest thing you get is, you know, Sidney Lumet does The Wiz, you know, which is like the craziest fucking thing ever. But the other thing is that, you know, they suffer to a certain extent because they're not even though they are acclaimed filmmakers and well-known names, they're not the sort of, I don't know how to describe this. I don't want to use the word auteur because that's a loaded word, and to say that they're not auteurs is weird. But like, you know, I remember, I mean, growing up in the 80s, and I, you know, Pakula's name was a name I knew. But like, you know, it wasn't like you didn't see a film and say, oh, wow, hey, the new Pakula, you know, because he was, you know, he was making movies and they weren't necessarily always well-liked. Sidney Lumet the same. I mean, I was younger, but like they weren't like Kubrick or these kind of filmmakers whose names had become bigger than themselves.
Yes.
You know, and people sometimes refer to them as hacks, you know, which they absolutely were not. They were like the opposite of hacks.
The absolute opposite of a hack.
I mean, they were hacks, they could have done, you know, they could have done so much stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But stuff like, was it Consenting Adults? Was that the movie?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, like all these films that they did, and really they're ripe for rediscovery. I mean, we've talked about Pelican Brief, and you talked about, thank you, talked about Pelican Brief a few times on this podcast, but you know, Pelican Brief at the time, you know, we dismissed it because, oh, another Grisham movie. Of course, the other Grisham movies had been made by, like, you know, Sidney Pollack. Yeah, I mean, like, it's not like these people were chopped liver making them. But, you know, we thought of them as, oh, these are, you know, potboilers, you know, pulpy, money grab movies starring, you know, oh, Tom Cruise, you know, Julia Roberts.
Yes.
You know, these movie stars, yuck, you know. And now I'm like, oh, God, Julia Roberts, please make more movies, you know. It's like, you know, we have a Tom Cruise courtroom drama right now.
Oh my God. And that's why sort of Charlie Wilson's War, which I rewatched very recently, I'm like, God damn it, this is great. Hanks, Julia Roberts, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm like, give me some movie stars, baby. I'm in.
I finally watched Mark Felt. And while it's not a good movie, really, but I was like, you know what? I'll take it. I'll take it. This is like you wanted a really good burger but you didn't get the good burger. You got the kind of not very good burger, but it's still a burger. You know, like I hate, like, I hey, hate
Hey, what do I expect? I wanted a burger. This is absolutely a burger. It is not a gourmet burger, but it hit the spot. It's probably going to make me feel a little bit sick later, but I'm okay
it's
right
2 a.m. burger. It's okay, you know. No, but I mean, look, it's that film has, there are fascinating things about that film. It's not, you know, it's not all that well made, but
what I like
that type of film, I was like, please, more. Okay, this one didn't work all that well, but like, make another one. You'll get it right eventually. I want these.
I think with all those guys, though, and this is a very peculiar observation, is he seems like a guy who liked the right ingredients when he was making a movie. So where you've got someone like, you know, in our contemporary sense, everyone's talking about it in the context of Nolan. I think Nolan's a good comparison to like Kubrick, because a Nolan film is a Nolan film and a Kubrick film is a Kubrick film. But Pakula kind of got off on, I'm going to have some of my sort of foundational elements of my movies. I'm going to have my Willis, you know, because I have that relationship. But he liked the soup of, I'm going to get a new screenwriter for this, and I'm going to get some big different actors and just see what they bring to it. And that sort of like more, I don't know whether it's that more collaborative tone that seems to happen in his career, that's like people sort of diminish his voice. But I think when you go back and look at what he's able to do, his approach is what stands out more so than like, you know, necessarily an identical visual language or something like that, or a script. You know, when you're a writer director, it's more like his approach and getting these absolutely phenomenally nuanced performances out of people, and very morally complex, and having this really, you know, overwhelming worldview of things that are sinister, that are simmering on the edges of the frame always. And you go back and you're like, actually, it is a kind of classical authorial voice, but it's, you know, people like a Soderbergh get away with, you know, are like a Pakula in many ways, you know, because he's a guy who mixes it up with different people when he's making the films. He's evolved his own style, so he's like the man in charge. But you know, I feel like they're kind of like a past and a sort of their contemporary sort of analog is like a Soderbergh for me, because he's like, you inject the same great ingredients, new people come in, and the films kind of go up and down in terms of quality. They're not all like masterpieces, but when they hit, it's so overwhelming.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I think that part of it is also that they have, you know, with Pakula, I think that there's, you know, all these directors, they are defined to a certain extent by the quality of the scripts that they get.
Yes.
And you'll see a situation like, say, you know, Rob Reiner isn't one of these guys. Rob Reiner comes later and he comes, you know, from a different world and, you know, he makes different movies, but, you know, there's an example there of, you know, he has this great run where he's just getting just the best scripts.
The greatest scripts of all time.
Yeah. He's clearly a gifted director. It's not like he's a hack, but you know, like he is getting the best fucking scripts and he is making the best movies out of them. I mean, you know, and it's just like this incredible run. It's like a Kubrickian run, right? Oh, like it's like he just, every one of them hit. But then the script stopped coming and suddenly, you know, he's to use an expression that has gained new dimensions of late, he's left holding his dick in his hands, you know?
but that's like exactly as you just said. So you've got, this is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, Forget North, that like then The American President, and like, they're all amazing. They're all amazing films. And then later on, like his most recent directorial effort in 2017, Shock and Awe. Again, Harrelson, James Marsden, Tommy Lee Jones, like again, a journalism movie, you know, one that I've looked at in reference to this because it's like one of the more contemporary ones. But it is like, this isn't a 2 a.m. burger. This is a 4 a.m. burger. Like it does not have any punch whatsoever. And any of that snap, crackle and pop of those other films are not evident in this movie. And it's very flat and very drab and visually uninteresting. And the script is kind of rote. And you're like, man, this is the guy who made This Is Spinal Tap. And none of that energy or exuberance is left. Like it's just gone. And so, you know, he's a great filmmaker, but yeah, to your point, it's like the scripts were everything.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the thing. That's the thing that distinguishes a Rob Reiner, who I have plenty of respect for, from a Pakula or Lumet. Even, I mean, Lumet is maybe, you know, at this point he's a step above, maybe, but you know, or Arthur Penn. Like, these guys really did every time, and they had their share of flops, but and bad movies. But it's, you never got the sense that it was tired. You never got the sense that it was like, ah, you know, they just kind of gave up. They're always trying to figure out a way in. They're always trying to figure out a way to make the material sing and to make it better than it is, even when it's good, even when the script is good. It's like, the director's job isn't just to, like, shoot the script. The director's job is to get a great script and find a way to make it even better, right?
Yes.
And I get that from Pakula. You know, I get that from Lumet. I get that from a lot of these guys. And you know, it's sad because we don't see a ton of those kinds of directors anymore. I think sometimes they come about, but we also don't always know what's going on. I mean, you know, studios in some ways are more powerful in the way that they can kind of manhandle these productions through. The margins, both financial and creative, are much more brutal these days. So these filmmakers don't necessarily have the freedom to try new things, you know, or if they're trying new things, they're working in the indie space and just kind of, you know,
In the streaming space, where the straight to streaming, like, it's less consequential. You know, they're talking about the hits, and, you know, people can, you know, someone who's you see some of these films pop up and you're like, you would never see. And I've mentioned this film so many times because I saw it for the first time this year, and it's affected me because it's such a, in my mind, such a great film. Sidney Lumet made a film called Night Falls in Manhattan in 1996 with Andy Garcia, which is a terrific film. You would never see a Night Falls on Manhattan ever again at the theater. Like, in my mind, you just would never see a movie like that. You would see a dime a dozen of them on Netflix or something that's going for that. And then at the same token, it's that weird thing, like you said, it's like, if it's a cinematic thing, the studio still have the power to flex and change it, and not many people can withstand it to that certain level. But then you get something like Night Falls on Manhattan, if it was going to go to Netflix, and it might never be Night Falls on Manhattan because there's no studio interference, and you can just make whatever you want and there seems to be no control. It's like, yeah, make it. And sometimes you get The Irishman, and then sometimes you get whatever that goddamn that movie that was released on the day of the Super Bowl. I can't even remember what, the Cloverfield like paradox.
Oh, God. That I think was a case where it had been made under the studio and then Netflix sold to Netflix. Because they knew it was horrible and they didn't want to have this like huge theatrical flop on their hands. So they were like, Netflix, you take it. You know, I never saw that one. That's the other thing about watching a film like All the President's Men. I can't remember if we talked about this last time, but there's a comfort food quality to this movie, which makes it so rewatchable. It's not just the fact that it's like a story of journalism, and it's kind of old fashioned isn't the word, but that sort of 70s style. For me, actually, there's a comfort food quality to it because I grew up in Washington, D.C., so I just love movies set in Washington, D.C., even when they're not shot in Washington. Like, In the Line of Fire is one of my favorite movies, and I think that was shot in Philadelphia, but, like, there's enough D.C.-ness that I'd love to watch it for that reason. But there is also, I think, you know, there is a kind of comfort food quality to just the how well made it is.
Yes.
And how, you know, this ability to tell your story in a low-key way that is still incredibly gripping, still honors the mystery and the tension of the story, but doesn't beat you over the head with it, gives you the room to sort of reflect on what you're seeing, gives the actors room to breathe, gives the actors a chance to do their thing. I mean, the Oscar nominations for acting that came out of this movie, you know, it's or like Jane Alexander, you know, like these actors who don't get a ton of screen time, but they get their moments, right? They get their scenes and they nail it.
Let's just mention a couple of them, which is Jane Alexander is the bookkeeper. She absolutely crushes it. Penny Fuller, who plays Sally Aitken, is absolutely phenomenal. Robert Walden, who plays Donald Segretti, you just don't make faces like that in Hollywood anymore. Like, give me 100 Robert Walden faces compared to some of the people you see. Like, and yeah, like even, you know, as much as he's not a person you want to talk to, talk about really in a contemporary context anymore, but even someone like Stephen Collins plays his role well. As Hugh Sloan, slippery Hugh Sloan, and Hal Holbrook, of course, as Deep Throat is outstanding. And then the main guys, Jack Warden too, Ned Beatty for like 10 minutes comes in as Dardis. He's in both of the big journalism movies of that year. It's like, it's
so great. It's so great. And that weird, you know, that weird like resistance that he does. And then finally he turns to the safe and like, you know, yeah. And they all get their moments and, you know, it's a director like this is able to give them their moments to kind of let the camera run, let the actor do their thing. But still do it in a cinematic way so that you don't feel like you're watching, you know, cam theater, quote unquote. Yes. It's really powerful, and that's why a film like this, you know, you can just watch, even though it's about incredibly dark things, it's a sinister movie. You can just watch it and watch it and watch it, and you can just like throw it on, and you know,
and before you know, it's got its hooks in you. It might feel like a lullaby, and then you're like, this is so good. You just start saying the same thing out loud. It's like when you put on the very best movies, and that's what was one of the appeals. It's like, this movie lulled me into doing this project for that very reason, because it is so compulsively watchable. Like, you just put it on. It's the first thing on video on demand, A, for all the President's Men there. And I'm like, I'm indecision in the Netflix queue, and there it is in the Apple iTunes. Click All the President's Men. And you just watch it, and it's just there.
And to kind of bring it full circle, Robards is, you know, his delivery and his kind of sort of, you know, low-key intensity is emblematic of the movie.
Yes.
Right? Like, the movie actually kind of has his cadences, you know, kind of casual, not always letting you know exactly what's happening. You can sense that something is happening under the surface.
And then when it snaps and crackles and pops, it hits, like, it hits really hard, and it comes at you in an unexpected way. And even the cadence of this brilliant piece of dialogue, like, you don't know where it's going to go. And he's like, I bet you're pretty tired. And just the way that it, the whole structure of this monologue is just wonderful. It's so wonderful.
And his pauses, the way he pauses, and everything he says, you think is the last thing he's saying.
Yes.
Right, it's like, I don't have the lines in front of you. You know it better than I do. But the way he uses pauses is, you're like, okay, he's done. No, wait. But that could be a bad thing too, right? That could be kind of an annoying actory thing to do. But you get the sense that, I mean, every actor is supposed to do this, and in truth, very few actors actually are able to do this. Although I will say, every single actor in All the President's Men is able to do this. You get the sense that they, at any given point, that they don't really know what they're going to say next.
Yes. Yes. Right? And that
present tense.
That's the best part of the Hoffman scene with the bookkeeper, where he feels so much like he's seeking for the best thing to say, and it may not be the best thing to say. Like, yeah. And so when Bradley's doing this rolling thing, these are the lines. You know the results of the latest Gallup poll? Half the country never heard of Watergate. Nobody gives a shit.
You think that's the end of the scene?
It could be the end of the scene.
But then what does he say?
And he goes, you guys are probably pretty tired, right? Well, you should be. Go on home, get a nice hot bath, rest up 15 minutes, then get your asses back in gear.
Then it's done, right? That's the end of the scene, right?
That's the end of the scene.
Yeah, he couldn't have an additional thought, could he?
We're under a lot of pressure, you know, and you put us there. That could be the end of the scene too.
Right, but that's it. Fade to black.
Fade to black, nothing. Nothing. But then he's like, nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment to the Constitution, freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country. Again, another yawning gap in the thought. Not that
end
any
of
that.
Right? End of scene. Great way to end the scene.
And then, not that any of that matters, but if you guys fuck up again, I'm going to get mad. And that is actually where the scene ends. And he said that he has the courtesy to go, good night. Like, it's actually done. I'm saying good night and we're done. Thank you.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, no, it's actually, I mean, that is a Robards thing too, like that ability to pause at just the right moments.
Oh my goodness.
He does that in Once Upon a Time in the West too, which is great.
That is another quality of this movie, is real faces, real people, real pauses. Nothing feels like, you know, Deep Throat says he hates inexactitudes and shallowness, and every character who is saying things in this movie feels like a real human being and feels like that they're considering what they're saying and feels like they're saying. And so that naturalism is so underrated. It's so deeply underrated.
And people don't do it anymore. That's the thing. It's so rare to see it. Even in indie movies, I mean, I don't know what it is. I don't know what's the magic of, Pakula's, acclaimed as a director, but I don't know that he was doing anything like incredibly special, but he kept getting these incredible performances out of people. It is really remarkable. The one guy who does get that is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh my goodness, does he ever?
He gets it. Like, he's able to like get those kinds of like, okay, this person is getting their moment. And this is gonna be the best fucking thing this person has
This is gonna be the best fucking Jenna Malone scene you've ever seen. And she just comes in. This is going to be your favorite Martin Short performance in 25 years. And he just comes in and absolutely crushes it. Oh man, what a he's a guy.
And he's a student of these types of filmmakers, and in his own way is trying to kind of keep it going. But oddly enough, the only way he can keep that going is by establishing himself as a capital A auteur.
Yes.
So that it's never really the project. It's that people are like, I have to work with Paul Thomas Anderson because he is like A-list,
Yeah. Because
he's able to carve that kind of independence.
He will give me the platform. And I think that's actually what it is. It's like you said, like that cinema is theater, where there's just like a camera and people are sort of like, it's completely visually uninteresting, lacks all that dynamism. But I think that's what's so amazing about this film. And it's even in one of the most recent episodes that's been recorded, just talking about the awareness of a cut. There's a moment before Sally Aitken gets a second with Dustin Hoffman's Carl Bernstein to interrupt him about the Canuck letter, which leads to another great Bradley scene, which we've talked about at length if you've listened to the show up to this point. And if you haven't, go back. But just the awareness of Pakula to just go, they do this beautiful sweeping shot of Bernstein coming out of there, asking for a cigarette, getting his messages. And Sally Aitken goes, Carl. And the camera cuts to her. It cuts to her first. And then it goes back to the other setup. And there is just something so magnificent. It's like, it's not showy. It's already done this beautiful setup to show you the expanse of the office. But the edit tells you Sally is interrupting our flow for a reason. And just that awareness, like giving someone the platform, even that 2 seconds that she's in that minute, as an example, is great. And this movie's pretty, in summary, after 133 episodes of this show and almost whatever it is, 100 something hours of talking about it, this movie continues to be very, very fucking good. It's very good. It's very good.
It really is. The other thing you said a little while ago that I remember I wanted to note, you've probably discussed this, this whole thing about Bernstein being afraid of saying the wrong thing.
Yes.
What I love about the dynamic between them is like Woodward is always knows the right thing to say. Right. Right. Bernstein's like peppering her with questions and Woodward's like, forget it. We don't want you to do anything that would make you uncomfortable. Like, he knows the thing to say, and he's like, he's suave in that way. And of course, I don't know if he's suave because he's also one of the producers of the movie and he played the wrong record. But
I think yes to all. It's yes to all. It's the character. It's Redford. It's the Inquisition. It's him being a more intuitive interviewer. And you see Carl learn from him. And Carl's usually the blustery one. But then there's a great one with Sally Aitken. Is he telling me did he ask you to go to bed with you? And Bernstein like looks at Woodward like, what happened to Mr. Suave?
My line. Yeah.
That's my line, you jerk. So great.
Yeah, no, it's watching the dynamic. That's the other thing. I mean, every time I watch the film, I'm able to focus on something else, like some other element of it. I mean, you enjoy the whole film, and obviously you're aware of all these things, but sometimes you can just watch it and just focus on one thing. And that's the marvel of a movie like this, is that you can rewatch it and see new things. And when people say you can watch a new movie and see something new in it every time, they're not necessarily saying that like you weren't paying attention before. They're saying that like there might have been some element that you're aware of, but like maybe this time it jumps forth.
Yeah.
And the last time I saw the film, that was what really jumped forth, is the way their relationship changes, not just in the way they interact with each other, but in the way they interact, like their relationship, the changes in their relationship are in some ways measured by the way they interact with other people, which is a yes. great, really hard thing to do as a screenwriter, as an actor, as a filmmaker. Like that's like, as our friend Michael Mann likes to say, extremely high degree of difficulty.
You know, like, yeah, you are playing 3D chess with your own movie, saying that you are designing how to do that. And you have to have the relationship down and you have to do all those things. And also sometimes it just doesn't work. It doesn't gel. You don't catch it. You don't catch the looks. You don't know the cuts. You don't have the edits. You don't have the coverage to hit it. And that's what this movie is great for. And that's the massive...
Or it winds up being too subtle and, you know, nobody sees your movie and it's forgotten, you know?
Yes.
So.
Well, this won't be forgotten. And this conversation... will be unforgettable in the context of this show. Bilge Biri, thank you so much for endorsing my madness with another minute-by-minute deep dive show right from the outset, and then surviving 2020 far enough to come back 132 episodes later.
And I will say, I really enjoyed this, and I'm glad I got to come back. I remember I was very honored to be the first one. But then I saw the first minute and I was like, I get a blank piece of paper.
and that is exactly why I had to have you back, because I did the same thing happen with Maria Lewis, who's a dear friend of mine. She literally was like, you gave me a fucking like a black screen. What do I do with that? What do I do with that? This movie's so great and you give me this black screen.
This is like when you do your inevitable minute by minute podcast of Derek Jarman's Blue. It's gonna be everybody's experience.
That is exclusive for the Patreon. This Derek Jarman's Blue minute by minute. Bilge, man, thank you so much. It's great to chat to you as always. And yeah, we are so close to the end of this project, and I'm sure you'll be back for our next one. So thank you so much for doing this again.
Thank
you. Bilge Ebiri, the first guest and the only guest that I could have imagined to speak in that minute. At Bilge Ebiri is where you can find him on Twitter. That's the best place. At BILGEEBIRI. One of the greatest minutes in this movie. A real showstopper. And one of my dearest friends to talk through it. He's an absolute legend. Folks, at ATPM Pod is where you can find the last bits of information about this show. One Blake Minute on both Twitter and Instagram. OneHeatMinute.com for all of our projects, including this one. If you want to support us, there should be a donation link that you can hit in the bottom of this. Otherwise, you can support us on Patreon, and you'll get a weekly podcast called Rum and Rant, where I go through many other topics, sometimes minutes from other films that we're not covering, just to chat about it. That's at Patreon/OneHeatMinute. We'll catch you on another episode tomorrow, as we are winding in to the final minutes of this show. 4 episodes to go.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.